Welcome to the Strong Source Commodity Podcast. We are your hosts, Martijn Bron and Alexander Sterk.
Welcome, listeners, to yet another episode of the Strong Source Commodity Podcast. And today we have a very special guest. I'm very happy that he is willing to participate. It cost us quite some persuasion. But yeah, we have today Fausto Felice, and we're going to figure out in today's podcast whether he is the king of wheat or whether he has been the king of wheat. I haven't seen Fausto for over 20 years, so I was really looking forward to what he looks like, and he hasn't changed much. So when did I work with Fausto? Because I worked with him. In 2003, I moved from Amsterdam to Geneva, working for Cargill in an office which was called at the time World Trading Unit. And I was on the same floor as Fausto. I was not part of his team. I was trading vegetable oil for the European grains and oilseeds business. And I sat across from him, maybe a couple of meters. And across from Fausto was another guy called Roger Jansson. And both were wheat traders. And when I arrived, I quickly learned that Fausto was a legendary trader within Cargill. And Fausto, you have to confirm this to me or decline it, but I recall you one time in the summer coming into the office with shorts and slippers, and I think you were the only one who was able to get away with that, because you're not going to challenge the guy who always makes money, right? But you tell me whether I saw this in a dream or whether I actually saw it on the floor. Now, and the interesting thing about Fausto and Jansson, Roger Jansson, which is a Dutch guy, very kind guy, was that Jansson, very intelligent guy, but he was known for swearing a lot. So I was amazed how much Jansson was swearing the whole day. And then Fausto keeping up with that. I never heard Fausto swearing. So it was two completely different characters working well together on that floor. Yeah, so that is basically some of the things that I recall from that period. Why we wanted to have Fausto in the podcast, because I recall that time, but also when I started reading The Word for Sale, the famous book about commodity trading, Javier Blas, that covered a period that I did not experience. And that was in the 70s, but also in the 80s. And I think that is a period that Fausto can tell us about, what it was when commodity markets were less transparent, and when it was all about your network and making deals rather than having access to a huge amount of information in transparent markets. So that was a reason why I thought, okay, Fausto can give us some insights about that period. And also, we had Rob Gosman in the podcast, the former British Petroleum head of light ends trading. And he referred to you in a quite emotional part of that podcast. He talked about leadership, and we asked him, so what leaders do you recall? And he mentioned you, and it was almost like with tears in his voice. I don't know whether it was the technology, but he was almost getting emotional about you and he having looked back at his career and what leaders were great to him. And he mentioned you. And then we thought, yeah, okay, we need to have Fausto. So it's a bit long introduction, but I think it is justified your career. Long career in Cargill, long career in Bungie, and a super kind guy, and everyone who knows you is talking very positively about you. So, yeah, I thought about do a bit of long introduction, but yeah, you're worth it, my friend. Yeah.
It's indeed a very long one. So we're very looking forward to this. But also, Fausto, what I think is very interesting is like what I see often, and I think a good trader doesn't make a good leader immediately, right? So you get two different things, and apparently you are both. So I'm really curious what is that you have both in it. So welcome to the podcast. Floor is yours.
Well, maybe the first question then is, can you introduce yourself? And because what I did was a small part, but can you introduce yourself to the audience?
Okay, well, that's that's a long introduction. And I don't know what Rob told you, but he's a bit emotional. And some of the stuff he says about me, even in front of me, is, I think, more urban legend than reality. But okay, I'll take it. So no, my name is Fausto Felice. I'm an Italian national. I was born and raised in southern Italy. I immigrated to the U.S. when I was a small boy. I was 10 years old. I did all my university and all my studies in the U.S. That's why I speak English like an American. I moved back to Italy in 1985, actually 84, year of university. Then I was hired by Cargill in 85, and I worked in Cargill Italy for 2 years. I was transferred to Geneva in 87. I worked in Geneva for Cargill for till 2012. Left, I took a year sabbatical. And then when I came back, we couldn't come to an agreement with Cargill on what my next role would be. And I had an interesting offer from Bunge, and I went to Bunge for 6 years. And I retired exactly on my 60th birthday. It was 5 years ago. So I have 27 years of Cargill and 6 years of Bunge, always in commodity. So, yeah, so I started in 1985. So I think earlier you mentioned something about the grain markets in the 70s. I wasn't around in the 70s. I'm not that old, but I learned in the late 80s, and I was in Geneva during that whole breakdown of the Soviet Union and opening up of the grain markets. And then while I was at the wheat desk, I was also there in that period where the market transitioned from less government involvement, meaning from European Union, the Australian Wheat Board, the Canadian Wheat Board, all that was dismantled, and the markets became increasingly free markets. Any specific area? I mean, you talked about the deal-making area. I arrived in Geneva in 1987. I had 2 years of training in Italy, which was a fantastic place to learn. We were importing and distributing soybean meal into Italy, competing with the local crushers at that time, Ferruzzi and Continental. And I was taught the basics of trading, supply and demand, local supply and demand, what's arriving, what's being produced, what's being consumed. Are we going to have a deficit in the coming month or no? Regardless of what's happening on a global scale, you're trading a local market with a local S&D, local players. It was a fantastic learning opportunity. It involved everything, even though futures, freight, basis, FOB, Forex, logistics, everything that goes into physical grain trading. In a 2 year period there, I had a fantastic teacher who later left Cargill. But that was the base of my knowledge. I didn't come from a business school. I never studied business. I never studied finance. I was hired just pretty much by luck. And then I felt things fell nicely.
That's like how everybody ends up in this world of commodities, by luck, by coincidence. And Tell us a bit about the world of grains. What made grains so fantastic? What was this world about?
Well, again, when I was kind of a radical student looking for any job, I happened to fall into this world. And then I began to, I became quite good at it. And it's, then once I moved to Geneva and you start having more of a global mindset, global view, it is the grain trading, certainly from a global position, it is very interesting because you are incorporating in the thought process lots of, economics and geopolitics, et cetera, which is, I was always interested in. So, and that sort of, I knew nothing about agronomy. And frankly, you don't really need to know that much as a grain trader. It helps to know a little bit, but you learn that as you go along.
And how's the dynamics of the grain market? Is it extremely volatile? Is it, what happens in the US and Europe and China? Or tell us a bit more about these dynamics of the grain market.
We can go over, I can go a little bit over how the market has evolved. So, this is what you were referring to earlier about the grain making deals, the periods.
Yeah.
When I was in the late 80s, early 90s, the world was sitting, particularly the European Union and wasn't called the European Union back then, it was called the EEC in the United States. We're sitting on huge stocks of intervention stocks of grain, and they were competing for export markets, and they had developed all these subsidy systems to reduce their grain. It was costing them fortunes. There were periods where the big grain, particularly wheat and barley, were basically the two grain stocks where the grain trade would go and work out these deals with importing governments, particularly government entities like in Egypt and Yemen and Algeria and what have you, these big, large government entities. And then they would go and bid either US or the EU or Brussels to who would give them most subsidies. And that was sort of, you know, these were Cargill and the big companies had a big advantage because they can finance and they can logisticate, you know, huge volumes of grain. So that was their first period of, you know, they would go to the Chinese and back then the Soviet Union, but the Soviet Union was a little before, but where they would sort of try to lock in some, at least a bid, and then go and shop around to see who would give you the most subsidies on that bid. So that was a very peculiar period. And trading back then, futures trading, and it was very difficult because there was the volatility was no, there was such an abundance of oversupply of grain that the futures were, you didn't really make much money at futures. Grain trading back then was basically wheat and barley trading. Those were the desks that were the dominant in Geneva for Cargill and in general for most of the trading companies. Corn and soybeans were okay. We started the soy. I started as a soybean trader in Geneva for 5 years, and we were corn and soybeans were basically the small brothers of the wheat desk. Wheat was where, and that's where we had all the historical Cargill legends, Hugh Spearings and Dave Rogers and Norman Hay. Those are the people that were more there in that period of the deal making, what I call the deal making era. And then the Soviet Union broke down, and there was additional deals to be made with some of the ex republics that broke up, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, and there was another period of 4 or 5 years where there was some in both exporting and importing countries where these guys would be able to do some financing and get in between some of these large volume deals. Then all that sort of came to an end slowly. And now the wheat market, and more like most of the markets, it's become extremely fragmented, lots of players. You know, it's lots of different origins.
Was that different in the beginning, that there was less fragmented? Was it?
Yeah, it was. Well, okay. The obviously Russia and Ukraine were not exporters; they're actually importers. So you had back then, you still had the big. You have the U.S., Canada, Australia, Argentina, and the EU were the five exporters, and then later that begins to. So there was some overlap in the intersection of some of what these origins were exporting to, and well, two of those origins were actually monopolies, right? The Australian Wheat Board and the Canadian Wheat Board were monopolies. So the real free market was the U.S. in Europe to a certain extent, but Europe also, you know, required for quite a bit of time, it was not really a free market. It involved getting export subsidies. So, you know, you had to kind of know what was going on in Brussels and with the different lobbies and different connection and who do you speak to and et cetera, et cetera. It was not like a flowing free market like it is today.
Basically, did it mean that you had to travel to a lot of those places and to build your network and get access to those deals, or could you do that?
No. Well, I took over the wheat desk in 2000. All that was over. We still had some with Roger, as you were mentioned earlier. There were still some first few years. There was still some subsidy system out of Europe that lasted for a couple of years, and then it was all gone. Well, we would every Thursday you would bid for subsidies for X amount of tonnage, and then it wasn't linked to a particular destination. It was you can export it to anywhere. But that was over fairly quickly, and then of course slowly Russia became a dominant player, and Cargill was one of the players in Russia along with other multinationals and of course local Russians. That's all changed now post war, where all the multinationals have been kicked out. The deal-making stuff came to an end in the late 90s, early 2000s. And now you've got a very fragmented market with different origins. Each origin has got niche players that are very, very strong in that geography. And you still have the big multinationals that are active in all the geographies, except for Russia right now. But the dominant position that they had earlier, I think, is much... is gone, or it's much less prevalent today.
Did your job also change then to the extent that you also started to focus more on the futures trading? Because
we always did that. I mean, okay, I traded soybeans for the first 5 years I was in Geneva. Mm-hmm. And back then, soybeans was a small market. But it was, again, another learning area because we had a big paper market in ARA. We had a big paper market in FOB Brazil, a paper market in FOB Argentina. So in Geneva, we had, you know, several markets to play with. Then I moved to the corn. I traded corn from 1993 till 2000. So I was the head of the corn desk for those years. And that was more of just building a gigantic shipping book, optional oriented. I think I got to about 13 million tons of custom freight book, which would came from all origins to all destinations. And that was where I think when you talk about, you know, this whole leadership stuff, I was never in a management position at Cargill. I was a desk head.
Yeah.
But I was a leader of a global virtual team, which involved, you know, people at origins, people at destination. And I think one of the things that I did well is was able to sort of get along with just about everyone and trying to, I guess the word is empathy, where you put your shoes in their shoes, whether you're speaking to a Korean or you're speaking to a Japanese or somebody in China or somebody in Argentina on the origin side or somebody in the US. And so the idea is to have as much as possible this global team working, in chorus and as opposed to trying to take advantage of each other, which frankly was for the longest time in my early career, it was the Cargill model, where the origins and destinations didn't trust each other. Yeah. Everyone is trying to take advantage. So yeah, I was one of the guys that was, again, I was always given credit for being able to pull some of these virtual teams together. And I continued that on the wheat team as well. And when the opportunities did come along in 2007, 2008, when the wheat market really just exploded and it became very complicated, you know, we had a fine, a well-oiled team around the world, and working and communicating in an optimal manner, we were able to read the markets correctly for a while. So again, it was kind of people talk about, I was just there at the right time with the right experience, with the right team.
But yeah. You mentioned something very, very interesting. And sometimes people think leadership has to do with the formal title. Yeah. But you know the saying, that the toughest negotiation within Cargill is always in the same company, right? And I recall these discussions whereby if the European business wanted to sell soybeans to Geneva then said, there's no buyer. But if the European business wanted to buy soybeans, Geneva said, but you need to compete with the Chinese. Right? Yeah. It was always that. And there were some big egos and some big characters. And indeed, there were often wars within, this may be exaggerated, but...
This was the culture certainly in the 80s and early 90s when I first got there. That was definitely the culture was more to you just got to take advantage of any opportunities you see, and it doesn't matter who's on the other side. You were basically trained or to be kind of vicious, even for people that are not naturally aggressive. You needed to be allowed.
How did you deal with that? And also for people's perspective, and Geneva was. No, and I was there for 3 years, and I enjoyed it, but I had to get used to that because I came from Amsterdam where there was a lot of camaraderie and people I knew. And then I arrived in Geneva, and then I saw all those egos and in quite individualistic approach, and P&L was everything. I had to really get adjusted to that.
Is that such a big difference in Cargill's if you got from Schiphol or then
at
to...
At the time it was. It was
Geneva?
Yeah, Geneva was... The collection of the best and the brightest, not necessarily Swiss people, maybe Swiss people in the back offices, but the floors was filled with Americans, Dutch people, English people, Argentine, Brazilians.
But did you see the same, Fausto, when you weren't in Bungie, for example, that you had, for example, a different office, had a different, was it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Again, all these major corporations have struggled with this sort of... centralization versus leaving authority at the destinations or at the origins. So you need you don't want to over centralize, but you don't want everyone to want everybody doing whatever they want. So, and it's that balance has always been a struggle. You know, I think the big change in cargo was during that one strategic, one of the restructurings that they did called strategic intent. You mm-hmm. must have been there. That's when they finally pulled the crushing and the grain trading under the same umbrella and the same group. And that suddenly the big the fighting between the plants, the crushing plants, and the trading, that basically was brought under one umbrella, and it reduced it. Probably didn't kill it all, but it reduced it. So that was a big, also, I think people begin to realize that all the infighting, I think it served well the company in the beginning. I think there was, because, you know, one of the things you get out of that model is you get traders at origin and destinations who begin to show what they can do. If you have a totally centralized system and they're just executing orders from the center, it's difficult to see who the really bright people and who are the people that have the knack for it. I think, you know, all these corporations, I think it is something that they struggle with. And I think Bunge now has gone to a total product line driven model where you have one head of product line and he's the head of the product line for globally. And everyone starts kind of falls into line, and there's one global position, and it's almost again, it's much better for the supply chain because there's probably less friction in the supply chain, but it takes away a lot of maybe innovative trading and stuff.
That's an interesting one what you say about the centralizing your book, right? So that's it that I hear more often is about companies that says, yeah, should I have some smaller local books and then one big book above it, or should I have just one big centralized book? I mean, I think there is not there are on both sides there are success stories to tell. What is your view on that?
Well, yeah, it's different models, and it's like you're asking your football coach what's better at 3-5-3 or 3-4-2 or whatever. At the end of the day, it depends on the player. If you have the right players that are encouraged to have the right behaviors, then things will work. If you have a different opinion on the direction of the market and you're looking at the same variables, but people are having a different reading, which can happen. It's, you know, how do you deal with that? Do you totally ignore somebody that's maybe junior that is totally disagrees with you? Or, you know, do you discuss things? It really becomes, you know, how you do it. It really comes down to people, I think, more than money. People will make the model work or not work. If you just have disagreeable people, you're going to have disagreeable people. And no matter what model you use, they're going to create problems.
And is then because we also had, when I was trading in food, we changed from different locations that had models. Even in Europe, we had a Polish office that had, and a Dutch office, which was the main office where you had the main desk, and then we was a big client. And then we didn't know, but we actually were competing against each other in offers to a big client. And we found out later on that we were actually competing for that volumes. And that's not in the benefit of, in this case, then the trader, right? To have then centralized books. But I think also what is a big difference is all the communication tools that you have to share information within the group. And so I think people, what you say is key as well, Fausa. And I think that also the communication tools to share very quickly what's going on, being transparent within the organization. But of course, the sizes of some companies are just so massive, like a Cargill or a Bunge or things, that it makes it sometimes a bit more difficult. But it's a very tough topic. It's overall, at least.
Yeah, again, for me, it's again, it comes down. You mentioned earlier, you know, coming to the office in shorts and flip-flops or whatever, right?
Did you actually do that? Can you still recall that?
I don't know. For sure, there were some days where US holidays, where we were working in Geneva, and we were, you know, when the futures were closed and we would come in, or you are a Swiss holiday where the futures were open in the US, we would come in shorts. But normally, but again, it's all that stuff is semantics, because it's also part of, you know, we worked in a very high stress environment. I mean, we were constantly being judged, constantly under pressure, and your positions are working or not working. And so the informality or taking some of the pressure off, and, you know, and the joking around and the swearing and all that, it kind of takes some of that, it alleviates some of that pressure. I think that's why, because we all work very hard, and I you know, I was a super maniac about supply and demand and having the numbers updated. I would spend half my time going through each individual origin, each individual, you know, destinations, who's buying what, when, how it's going to happen, you know, projecting that forward and all that. That was what we called our bread and butter, because as Cargill, as one of the big boys, we should have the quality of the supply and demand should be second to none, frankly. And I think it was. So that, from, you know, the discipline, you know, you can't look at the informal approach to things, and then, but which kind of hides the professionality behind the work we were doing.
Good that you mentioned that, and the importance of, you know, doing the hard work, the nitty gritty. But you also mentioned stress. Now, when I arrived in Geneva in 2003, I had lunch with Emery Koenig, and it was already a done deal that I was there. But I asked him, so what kind of people do you look for in Geneva? And Emery Koenig at the time, he was the head of the... And he said, we look for people with an appetite for risk. People who are trading to win and not trading not to lose. Now, I found that an interesting statement. Later on, years later, I raised the same question to Alex Onfelio, who is now the head of WTU. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, it shifted a bit in our thinking. It's not only an appetite for risk, but you need to thrive in risk. Now, that all sounds very positive. And in fact, if I look at myself, it was rare that I experienced the situation as stressful, but I describe it rather as the environment is intense. It's a slightly different, it's a nuance, but stress is, you know, you can be negative if it takes a long time. And intensity basically means that you you need to do your best and perform. How do you say that in Dutch? Op je tenen lopen. What is that in English? Anyways. So,
on your toes.
My question to you is, how did you deal personally with that? Were you someone who thrived under stress? Or did you over time manage a situation where you said, well, you know, I like the work I'm doing and the S&Ds, the jokes, the environment. I like financial markets. And I have developed a certain way to deal with the intensity and the stress in order to do it for all those years. Because you said, in total, you traded for 40 years. At 20, what was it? 27 at Cargill and 13 at Bungie.
And 6 at Bungie.
Oh, yeah.
And 34.
Yeah, sorry. So, and people have asked me at times, are you still sitting on that desk? How is it that you managed to endure all that time? So my question to you is, how did you do that?
Well, again, it's the more time you spend there and the more experience you acquire, the least rattled you're going to be when things go wrong, because you've seen it before. But that doesn't mean it hurts less when, you know, when you made the wrong decisions and you're on the wrong side of the market and you need to make tough decisions whether to add or get out. It's never easy. Again, that's one of the beauty of the sole industry, because every time is different. You see situations that are similar, but there's always something there's a new element or a new variable, or the same variables, but they have different weightings, and you need to sort of what is most important today. And so it's I've always looked at this thing as a gigantic chess game, with the pieces never being exactly the same on the board. And you're looking at the board and you need to make a decision. You know, sometimes, from that point of view, like looking at it as a big game, maybe helps you take some of the stress off that you're going through a rough patch, but you'll get through it because you've gotten through it before many times. So I think the experience does help in terms of, you know, calm things down, and this is probably where the management or trading managers should, you know, that's, I think that's their role, is to calm things down and bring, you know, show confidence and show to the traders, especially when things go wrong. When things go right, there's no issues, obviously.
But do you think you need different people in the world of trading, like when you started, then now, or are the people different that do the same job? but then different times?
Well, things, yeah, again, things have changed so much now because, you know, ever since, you know, the other big change in the grain markets occurred in the 2000s when the technology and everything changed, and the advances in technology basically turned the grain markets upside down, because suddenly you introduced a whole new element, a whole new world to the grain markets. But in the 80s and 90s, let's face it, the grain trading was very marginal. Was not really the financial players, the banks weren't interested. And then in the 2000s, when they started getting interested with via the indexes and via the hedge funds, and suddenly, you know, commodities asset class and grains is a subclass of commodities. And then all the financial instruments that became the futures and the options have always been there, but the volumes that, you know, the increases in volumes and participation, this industry also brought it with it their whole risk management criteria. So, you know, the value at risk, yeah, drawdowns. So now we didn't have that in up to 2008. We still weren't using VAR,
yeah,
as a measurement of risk. We were still using, you know, how many tons, and now all the grain traders are trading exactly like hedge funds, and they have, regardless of who's the leader, you know, Alex could be a very good leader and he's a good trader, but he's got these corporate parameters which are tying his hands, basically. Even if there are certain parameters which he is not allowed to go over. Whereas in my time back then, we had a lot more leeway, and we had probably more management support, because I think at that time still we had management that understood what the, you know, top management were still coming. Some of them were still coming from the trading area, and I think they understood a lot more than the current top management in cargo probably. So that's changed. I think
do you think it's key for organizations that are in the world of commodities, the trading, that they have people in the management that actually understand the real business? Eh? So besides their great managers and
Ooh, absolutely. Yeah. I think it's key. I think right now, otherwise you just put a computer there, and so here's the parameters, and as soon as you touch that parameter, you're out. Even though you know, you should be doubling the position there instead of getting out, simply because you have some computer system or a manager that's behaving like a computer, and not somebody you can go and in a room say, oh, here, you know, we're getting our ass kicked for X, Y reason, but I think we need to stick with this, or anything we need to add to it because of X, Y, Z. And the person across from you can actually have a conversation with you. Say, yep, I agree. No, I don't agree. I think you're missing this or you're missing that. You have a discussion. But, you know, that today, I think there's a lot less of that going on in the big companies. And they've taken the hedge fund bank sort of model as risk management systems.
Yeah, because often these systems and these algorithms, they don't even know what necessarily the fundamentals of that commodity are. They trade volume or they trade trends.
It's a model. It's a model that works when you apply it to 100 different markets.
Yeah.
And statistically, obviously, some of these systematic trading do work, because they do apply it to whatever 100 markets, and you're gonna get knocked out of three, but then you catch a trend on the other ones, and et cetera, et cetera. So I'm not gonna knock what other people are doing. What has changed in the grain houses is that they've given away their competitive advantage in having supply and demand and kind of projecting forward prices. That advantage that they have, even though it's probably not as big as it used to be, they've kind of given it away, because they're not really trading that anymore. They're you know, I'm super bullish the whatever the corn market, and it starts going down, and I start losing money, and I get out simply because I've reached my limits.
Is there still? Do you think there's still money to make in the industry? Where, look, I'm not a grain trader, but I have the feeling, and correct me if I'm wrong, but with corn, with grains, that the margins are, you know, margins are already always thin in commodities, but even more thinner in these areas, and that the volumes are just massively. But with all the costs of financing, the cost of transport, etc., is it still a very interesting business to be in?
Oh, again, moving grain around the world has, in my career, has never been very interesting. I mean, it is a system that is extremely efficient. You're moving what we call replacement, particularly corn, where it's you know the barrier to entry in corn trading is not that big, and people can buy FOB, sell CNF, etc. And the destinations are almost always trading below replacement, and then you need to trade yourself into some sort of a margin. So from that point of view, I mean, if you put your FOB, your freight, to your costings, and you offer to Korea on any given day, you will never sell a kilo, right?
Yeah.
You have to discount it, and you need to speculate either on the freight going down, or you're already long and you're liquidating along or whatever. But from that point of view, the global system for grain is actually extremely efficient, and I don't. You know, it's been like that since my entire career. I don't see that changing.
Hey, Fausto, we always ask and people, you know, who you admire and who you learned things from. Now, and that is why Rob, I mentioned your name, but and you must have worked with some of the most well-known traders within cargo, maybe in the industry. Legends like Joep Spierings, Dave Rogers. I've met Dave because he was still active when I was in Geneva. Huub was already out. Now, obviously, David met Dimek, who later became the CEO of Cargill. You mentioned Norman Hay. Emery Koenig I worked with. Mm. But what was it like to work with these guys? And so what are the things that, if you think about your career with such, you know, legendary players, what were the things that you learn from them, and maybe especially in time when times were tough. How did it work with these guys?
When I first came to Geneva in 1987, Spierings was already the chairman, and then Dave Rogers came a year later and he became the trading manager. Norman Hay was the head of wheat, and then Emery came later. He was my boss. On beans, he was kind of the head of both beans and corn. I think these guys, Spierings was obviously a super bright person, but he could be very harsh. He was very harsh on people, and he could make people look bad, which sometimes it was the culture back then. You go into a trading meeting, and you're not sure what you want to do. You maybe don't have everything clear in your head, and this guy will destroy you. I've seen that over and over with people where he would make them. So that some of that style, I think, went away, and we got soft. Obviously, Dave Rogers is a lot more softer in his way of doing things, and. Also, all these people were very bright, but in his way of doing things and his kind of imposing his viewpoint on people was a little bit less dramatic than somebody like Spierings. He was the ultimate Dutchman back then. No, but again, in terms of the people that had influence on me, the guy actually that I taught probably the most is when I was the first 2 years in Milan. Mm. It was a guy named his name is Thomas Reinhardt, and he owns his family owned one of these historical cotton trading businesses.
So I know them. Really?
Yeah, right. And he didn't want to work for the family, so he worked for Cargill for a few years, and they sent him to Brazil, and then they sent him to Milan, an extremely bright person, very odd character. And then he went back to the family business, and I think he's probably still running the business now. But he was, for that year or two in Milan, the amount of time he spent with me, just going through the very basics, and that, I think, had it laid a very strong foundation for when I got to Geneva. Some of the stuff that he had taught me was extremely, extremely useful. Anyway, that's the name that obviously nobody would come up with. But he was very, very important very, very early in my career. And then, of course, the people that you mentioned earlier were all supportive. And I think he particularly recognized my talent, not so much as an intellect or as a big swinging trader, but as a team builder. And the fact that I was able to, you know, get people to work together that otherwise may not have worked together. That was the key. And that, I think, later when it became important and the opportunities were there, like I said earlier, our ducks were kind of in line to take advantage because we were working as a team.
Would you have recommend to young people that start in this industry to switch within commodities? To find new, to sometimes do new commodities, or do you think become an expert in just adding grains or in cocoa or oils?
Yeah, again, well, Rob Gossman is a great example. I mean, I don't know what he said about me, but he was one of the brightest people around, a hell of a lot brighter than I was, and he made that switch from grain to petroleum, and then he took off. I think it's the training is trading. So once you get that sort of mental process going, you can apply it to different. You just need to learn the idiosyncrasies of each commodity, but the concepts and the psychology of it is the same. So yeah, I think it's if people have the opportunity to move around, it's great. I was proposed to go into the energy space, but it was later in my career, and I was already kind of doing quite well, and starting from scratch or nearly from scratch would have been probably more of a challenge than I wanted it at that time. But other people have made that certainly from freight to grain. Roger Jensen, the guy he went from freight to grain back to grain, and then he also managed businesses, managed industries.
Yeah,
he was a.
Do you? Would you recommend? What would your advice be to people in this trading industry that are in the early stage?
Well, again, my advice is to learn the basics. I think people try to. Already over speculate on futures, just looking at charts and looking at momentum and all that. Okay, that's fine, but that's, for me, I don't consider that a very good base for trading. I think you need to have, for me, I'm a fundamental trader. I think you need to put in the time and learning about the markets that you're trading, learning the supply and demand is still the basic. I think our markets still work on supply and demand. They, the financials people are probably pushing some of these, pushing the markets away from fundamentals, both on the upside and the downside at times. But ultimately, the markets do come back to equilibrium. And we've seen this over and over again. Particularly, I think learning the fundamentals and putting in the time, that for me is key.
Thanks.
Hey, now, I've only worked in Cargill, so I don't know much about what it is like working in a company which is one of the ABCDs, and you can make a comparison. Yeah? When you leave Cargill, you realize, you hear it from a lot of people that there is a world outside of Cargill, and outside of Cargill there's plenty really good people. At the same time, when you meet people who have worked with Cargill, you immediately know that you share some values. There is a bond forever. Yeah? Like now, I'm talking to you like it was yesterday. Yeah?
Yeah.
I can transport myself back to that desk 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Now, I have the same with Sojanovic, our shared friends, Ivo. My question is, when you have such a strong bond with the company, and maybe even at the end you didn't agree on what the next move was, what was it like for you to move to Bunge? And can you share with us a bit insights of how that company worked and how that culture was and whether you saw things that were maybe very different or better? Yeah, because that's also one of the things that we wanted to, one of the reasons why we wanted to start this podcast. It's still somewhat of a intransparent industry, and the ABCDs, most people have no idea actually what these companies really do and about the people. You have worked in both companies. So can you share with us a bit more about how you experience Bunge?
Okay, so I think there is certainly there's a bond that you develop early in your career with the people that you kind of grow with, you know, that you've shared a lot of experiences with, both, you know, fun and less fun. So obviously, you know, when you earlier in your career, when you have a group of people that you grow with, the bond to those people is going to be special. And I don't think that's, you know, what I found at Bunge was exactly the same thing. I think there's a lot of people in Bunge that have been there for a very long time, that grew up, grew in the company together, and they have extremely strong bond, just like the people in Cargill do. So from that point of view, I think that culture is actually very similar. I think it's all, you know, ethically, they're all, you know, these companies behave the same way, and building teamwork and shared experiences and all that. I think they're very similar. So yeah, I came, you know, I came to Bunge as a mature trader with a reputation and experience. So I could not. It was difficult. I did my best to bond with those people as much as possible. But there's no way I would have the same bond with them, you know, coming in at a later stage when these people have grown together for 20, 25 years together. So, yeah, I think, and the same thing at Cargill. I mean, you do develop some bonds over the course of time that are special. And I think, at least I don't know about the other, ADM and Dreyfus, I haven't worked there, but Cargill and Bunge are very similar in that way. So some of the people that have worked there for a very long time have very, very strong relationships and a very healthy relationship. They're good. They're all good people.
And some people who leave the job, they continue to trade on their own account because, you know, the trading lifestyle is what they do. What happened with you when you quit Bunge and when you left the industry?
Yeah, I pretty much got out. I dabble, but things have changed so much that you really, if you're going to do it, you need to do it, which means you need to, especially the way I was being trained, I need to know the intricate details of the S&D, and if I'm going to do that, I'm going to spend a huge part of my time doing that. So no, I'm pretty much out.
You don't have a secret long position in coffee or
he's long olive oil.
No, literally, no. We have a little bit of my father left a little bit of land in Calabria. We put some olive oil,
nice
olive trees there. That's just with my cousins. I spent some time there.
And looking at the time, we already come to an hour, Fausto. That's how quick things can go.
Wow.
I at least have a final question for you, from my side at least, is that, yeah, do you have something about, you know, books, for example, that you would recommend to read for our audience that you would say, well, you know, now I have a lot of time in the mountains with my good olive oil and maybe it's a nice book or... that you could recommend?
No, I mean, on trading, not really. I mean, I don't. The time I spend, I usually try to read more fiction than nonfiction books. I don't really spend a lot of time on business books and self improvement, et cetera. Not really. I did go. I did page through the book on. And the the world for sale. And I actually should mention that that chapter that he wrote on the grain markets of 2008. I think there's, I'm not sure what he was trying to say there, but there was a lot of inaccuracies in that in that chapter. And I think the grain markets function very, very differently from the mineral markets, and where you're dealing with government, where you can buy concessions and licenses, et cetera. Grain is you originate, it's very capillary in how you originate, and it's very capillary how you distribute it, how you sell it. To come up with, I think in that chapter, he was trying to somehow, we had cornered, it's impossible to corner anything in our markets. there was so much confusion of that year between the financial market meltdown and the grain market rally, which were totally unrelated, by the way. The grain markets rallied because we just had a very bad streak of bad weather in major growing areas of the world. Russia, Europe, I think Australia had two consecutive droughts. And so we drew down grain stocks, and the grain market did what it needed to do. It went well above the cost of production. Next year, the year later, we brought in, you know, a huge amount of production. We were growing wheat on bloody terraces, and the grain market came back to equilibrium. Yeah. So people get, he seems to imply that somehow, you know, the speculators were squeezing the Chinese or the again, I don't know what it seemed very, very confusing, but the markets actually worked quite well because the spike was short-lived, and the markets came back to the move was exacerbated by, you know, some speculators. But then some of these speculators also must have lost a bunch of money on the way down because it came down very fast. So
Fausto,
maybe we should read that book. But I don't know.
I think it's very funny that you say that, because in 2008, and this is a critical thing, and it goes. You mentioned it before. The markets work. The markets are efficient. Yeah, they come to an equilibrium. But if you do not understand the market, then you don't know why it happens. And I give you a nice example of 2008 as well. 2008 ended the great financial crisis, and everything came crashing down. And at the time, I was trading cocoa. And one of the critical elements in cocoa trading is the dynamic between cocoa butter and powder. You can't make one without the other. It's a bit the same as soybean meal and oil. And I was doing presentations with customers who were buying both from us, from Cargill. And what happened in 2008, chocolate demand collapsed. So butter demand collapsed. But powder demand did not collapse at all. It remained stable because it was a fairly cheap product in the beginning. If one collapses and the other one is, in terms of the demand collapses and the other one stays the same, then the price needs to correct. So powder went absolutely through the roof. And people thought that we were behind it, that we were kind of cornering the powder market. But that was exactly what the market needed to do. Right. Powder market needed to go up in order to incentivize producers to produce it and get rid of cheap butter. It's brilliant. And if you look at last year, in the cocoa market, in the mainstream media, the opposite was happening. The specs were very early, and they eventually sold out their length into a panicking chocolate confectionery industry. The market worked perfectly. And that's also one of the reasons why we wanted to do the podcast, and to demystify some of these stories and to say, don't believe everything what you read in the mainstream media. Talk to the real traders. And do your homework and analyze the market.
Well, I know that coffee now is very expensive. However, I was at Starbucks getting a cappuccino. It was €5.40 here in Amsterdam. Yeah, I was really surprised.
You need to be incentivized no longer to drink coffee. You need to move to tea. That is what the market is saying.
Yeah, that's true. I should do something different. Well, water is going to be an issue as well, I think, over time, that there will be a water shortage. So maybe one of the traders can go to Huisheret doing a water position?
Well, that's the other, again, that's a whole other issue, because again, as Cargill and Bungie and all of us that have been involved in the world of trading, in the world of food, you know, we're all, I think most people I work with in Cargill are all very nice people, very honest people, hardworking people that are believing that they're doing the right thing. But
yes,
we're all together collectively participating in a food system that's environmentally very, very devastating and nutritionally not very good for a lot of people, because we're creating a huge amount of obesity and health issues, and pharmaceuticals are, you know, developing anti-obesity medicine to combat that. So collectively, we are, in a way, again, individually we're not guilty, but collectively we're guilty. We are all complicit in a food system that's not very healthy for the people, for the people that are consuming it, and for the environment that's producing it. But again, it's a different issue.
I was in London the last couple of days, and I had lunch, and there was on the menu, it was a lamb stew. And I thought that's nice, so I ordered the lamb stew, and it was really delicious. Yeah, I thought it was lamb stew because it said it on the label. And then later, the guy who gave it to me, he said, "Look, how did you like it?" And I said, "Yeah, it was really, really nice." And he said, "There's no lamb in it. It was vegan." So the thing
but
is,
they can call it lamb. Then.
Well, look, I think it was some kind of like fake lamb or whatever. Fake meat what I found interesting is that I'm 100% sure if they would have said, "Look, this is vegan, this is lamb-like, made from, you know, whatever they make it from soya," I would not have ordered it. Now I thought it was lamb. I think my brain was adjusting itself to this is lamb. You like lamb? It tastes great. So yeah.
Oh.
Anyways, I thought it was a nice
story. To shepherd's pie maybe next time in London.
Yeah. Anyways, look, we have come to an end. Look, I really appreciated it, Fausto. I think take away is the importance of teamwork. And that sounds obvious. And nowadays they call it very fancy collaboration. But at the end of the day, it's common sense. When you get people together and work together, you become successful. And you know, I've learned a lot more about the grains market, and I enjoyed seeing you. And that is really nice after all those years. So thanks a lot.
Thank you, Fausto.
That you were willing to participate.
We really enjoyed.
Yeah.
Okay. It was a pleasure, guys. Thanks very much. And good luck. I hope this is useful to somebody.
Yeah.
It definitely will. I really liked it. Thanks, Fausto. Really enjoyed.
Have a great weekend. Enjoy the slopes. Bye-bye. Enjoy the slopes.